You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. March. Welcome to March as well. Your official March greeter, Mike McNamara. What's up? Welcome to the Tribal Central of All Marine Radio and Post Traumatic Winning. Yeah. Boom. Both of them. I went to my daughter's swim meet yesterday, Colleen. She was dog paddling a year ago, and now she's swimming. Go figure, right? So anyway, I walk in, and like I've never had a kid that's been in swimming before, so I'm not really sure about the protocol, but she did play water polo, so I'm familiar with the layout of the pool and where the bleachers are, where the parents sit. So I walk in, and I'm looking for my ex-wife, Susan, and my daughter, Catherine, to see if they're there. So I'll find them and sit with them. And I look around, and then there's somebody waving, like, in my direction. But, like, I don't know them. I look, I'm like, and so I look behind me. I look behind me to see if, are they waving at somebody else? And there's nobody behind me. And I look and I point at myself. I'm like, me? And she's like, yes. And I look. I'm like, oh. So then I wave. Hey, it's the mom of one of Colleen's friends. I said, sorry. She looks at me and she's like, really? I didn't know. Come on. I meet a lot of people. That's right. So, needless to say, that was moderately awkward. But, hey, it's life, right? It's life. So then I just wanted to actually, here's what I did yesterday. So, I was listening to something that Eugene Sledge did, okay? And I got kind of curious about old Sledge. And the reason I got curious about Sledge was because I've been told that he struggled with alcohol after the war. Couldn't be because he was self-medicating. So in the course of doing a little research about Sledge, I found that he's written a second book. Yeah. It's called China Marine. Forward by Stephen Ambrose. Introduction by Joseph Alexander, who's actually Colonel, I think, United States Marine Corps. And then as I looked, it's got a Kindle edition for $16. An audiobook for $16. And so I had downloaded the audiobook. And I thought, well, look, I mean, nobody's here. If I'm here by myself, I'll watch the swim meet and I'll listen to Sledge, which is actually what I did. But Sledge kind of, so here's where the book picks up. The book picks up where the other book left off, and that is there in Okinawa, right, where he winds the other book down. So this picks up and kind of deals with pre-VJ Day stuff. So the fact that they heard that there was going to be, they heard about this thing called the atom bomb, but nobody knew what it was. What's an atom bomb? What kind of bomb is that? And you can imagine, right? They're living in tents on Okinawa. They're getting their news through wherever the hell they got it. Maybe did someone have a radio and listen to Armed Forces radio at the time? I don't know. And so he kind of describes him hearing about it and then hearing that the Japanese had surrendered, but they didn't believe it. Like, yeah, that's just because their experience is what? Japanese, they don't surrender, man. The biggest difference between the Eastern theater of war and the Western theater of war, right? The difference between fighting the Germans and fighting the Japanese. Japanese did not surrender. So they didn't believe it. And so he kind of walked you through that part of learning that they would survive the war. And then, well, what was going to happen next? Would they go to Japan as part of the occupation? And which they assumed they would, but they didn't. And so they go to China, and they go to Beijing, right inside the old imperial city where the legations were, right? So when you read Marine Corps history and you read about China Marines. In fact, one of the things he said is that somebody yells, hey, we're going to be China Marines. Because they were still in the Marine Corps, right? Guys that served in the 20s and the 30s in China. And before that, we're still in the Marine Corps. So around the and around the Marine Corps. So, hey, we're going to be China Marines. So anyway, but the book, as I came to find it, chronicles him in China, which is pretty interesting. And talks about you still had Japanese troops that were armed in China, that the United States was moving back to Japan by ship. You had and by aircraft, and so they were still armed. You had the Chinese communists, you had the Chinese nationalists, and then you had criminals in the area, like every other country has. And in the midst of that, the 5th Marine Regiment bombs in, along with the rest of the 1st Marine Division. They bomb into to China. And he talks about his life there. And then from there, he talks about going home. And it's the going home part that I wanted to talk about. But I want to play today. There's a 30, he gives a talk. And I want to play, it's about 30 minutes of audio. And so where he talks about war. And he gives it at a... He gives it at a university. And you'll enjoy it. You'll enjoy it. But it's, you know, it's he in his own words, and which I'm particularly fond of. I shouldn't tell you this, but I will. There's an audio version of With the Old Breed on the internet. Now, just so you know, you'll be violating a copyright, so I would advise against that. But, nonetheless, it is out there. I know that because I ran across it yesterday. So if you look for Sledge, if you're... But again, I would advise you not to violate his copyright. Go buy an edition of the book. It will benefit his estate. He gives this talk in May of 1994 at the Ludwig von Mises Institute's Cost of War Seminar. So we'll start the show, right? Yeah, I'm sure you're sick and tired of the whole North Korea and Michael Cohen narrative that you've got all week. So, under the guise of post-traumatic winning, these guys came home, and I had Ken Rogers on yesterday. We don't talk about it, right? You're not supposed to talk about it. You're supposed to handle your business as a man. And it's the most wrong-headed nonsense you've ever heard in your life. And I think that we should make that perfectly clear to those that follow us. That's wrong. You know, listen to this. Sledge had 1,000 pages of written, 1,000 pages written. And that's what became With the Old Breed. 1,000 handwritten pages he wrote. And he started writing that, he would have nightmares at night, and he would get up, and he would, as his own therapy, he would get up, and he would, in detail, write what happened. And that's how that book got written. And his wife, Jean, she wrote it. She typed it. And she was typing it, and their sons were reading it. And their sons would say, Mom, type faster. Type faster. I want to find out what happens. So it's not like he hid his experience from his wife and from his kids, from his sons. He had two sons. He has two sons. So, and that's how With the Old Breed got written. 1,000 handwritten pages. And his son said there were stacks of these tablets all over the house. He'd get up at night and he'd start writing. And that's where he wrote it. So, and that's how he dealt with the stuff. But again, I had Ken Rogers on yesterday, and I was talking about, you know, in a day and age when men handle their business, Manchester and William Manchester, who wrote Goodbye Darkness, and Eugene Sledge, they wrote, right? Sledge, and you know, writing just for himself. Right, as his way of kind of getting it out and talking about it, never envisioning that it would become a book, let alone the book that it became. So so pretty interesting stuff. And he I think the book gets published in 1981. So anyway, interesting stuff. But again, I had Ken Rogers on yesterday talking about, because Ken did the same thing. He came home and he drank. And then he went back to college to learn how to write because he wanted to somehow or other make sense of this thing. And the only way you can make sense of it is by talking about it. Right. And so he meets Betty, his wife now, and, they begin to do this documentary. And so we had Ken on talking about it yesterday about talking about it. So anyway, interesting. I find it very interesting stuff because again, I don't hear anybody saying in front of everybody, standing up saying, you have to talk about it. And I don't care. And look, if it's not, if you've never been to combat, but you have shit, you have to talk about it. You got to find people to talk about it. And so talk about it. Anyway, good morning to you on a Friday. You know, Whitney Houston makes it official. This is dedicated to Eugene Sludge, who's written the second book I'm listening to is extremely interesting. You know, you can see just as in this case I'm listening to this book, as you listen to the book, just what an articulate, thoughtful, pay attention kind of a guy that he was, as well as he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder. He didn't suffer bullshit well. And so he is all of that, which is our, you know, I'd like to say that quintessentially Marine type qualities. And, he puts all of that together in one package and then he writes. And so it's wonderful to read his work. And the stuff he writes about is all the stuff we talk about. So, dedicated to Eugene B. Sludge, a mortarman from Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines.
Thank you. You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front. With his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City, standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, you know, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once the bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the Corps, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful, and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran, or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day. And Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
Time to check the weather. And then we'll hear Eugene B. Sledge. Yeah, that's what we're doing today. All right, currently, cloudy 35 in Quantico. So it's cooled off there. Camp Lejeune, clouds at 59. Granbury, Texas got cold, clouds at 37. 29 Palms, cloudy and 54, so they stay warm. Camp Pendleton, clouds in 55. Okinawa, dark, cloudy, 68. Ramadi, clear, dark, and 55. Helmand Province is raining in 54 there. In the Costa Mesa, Newport Beach area of Southern California, it is cloudy in 58. Looking for a high of 64 with rain in the forecast tomorrow and Sunday. So good for us. Yeah, how about that? All right, we'll take a very quick break and we'll come back and you're going to hear Eugene. No, you know what? We're not going to take a break. Yeah, how about that? No, actually, a programming note. The chef's going to be on today. He'll be on at 9. General Zinni was supposed to come on today and talk about Iwo Jima, and he'll come on at some later date. Yeah, he had an emergency pop up, so he emailed me and said, "Hey, Mac, I can't do Friday. We'll do it again though." So, yeah, so I'm not giving that one up either, because he's my what I think is the epitome of what a Marine officer ought to be. The real quick stories new, right? About the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps is paranoid, and that's in quotes. The Navy does not play with others. This new study analyzes the effect of service rivalries. Written by Tara Kopp, who's a longtime writer about things. All right, this is a new study done by the RAND Corporation, looking at competitiveness between the services and how their culture succeeds or fails in beating out the other services for resources. Service personalities are alive and well, the RAND found, not only in a competition for budget dollars, but also for influential joint assignments and for integral missions in military operations. So it's a study that RAND has done about how the services compete. So that's in the news. Let's see. And that's it in terms of Marine Corps news. Top five stories in early bird. Number one is that story I just discussed. Number two is the security clearance process is about to get its biggest overhaul in 50 years, which is interesting because much in the news yesterday was a story that said that John Kelly wrote a memo after the president ordered him to issue Jared Kushner a top secret clearance. So that was in the news yesterday, so kind of an interesting story. On the heels of that. Number three, House Sea Power Chairman, early aircraft carrier decommissioning is a non-starter. Yeah, you know, that I saw that story. It's like, what in the hell is the intellectual basis for that? Right? We spend billions and billions of dollars for these assets, and they are, right, they're forecasted to last for how many years? 30, 40 years? And now we're going to retire one early for what reason? I'm talking about the Harry S. Truman. Number four report, if the military wants to hold on to special operators, they should do this. Yeah, I think what you're going to find is the military, as you see the process with special operators, right? The military, for convenience sake, has leaned on them too much. They've ridden them too hard. They expanded it too fast. Some of those missions should have gone to conventional forces, right? And then they're deployed too much. Even if you are paying it, their lives are shit shows. Their lives are shit shows. And they're away so much. You know, how do you have a family? How do you have a life? How do you stay married? Yeah. So there's big problems that need to be reconciled. Not only in how our special operations forces get used, but you know, how do you retain them as well? Number five commentary: North Korea's summit ends with no deal, but Trump's move sends a message that matters. What will Kim do now? And that comes out of Fox News, so you can bet which way that story leans. Overseas operation number one, U.S. offers $1 million reward for information about Hamza bin Laden, Osama Muhammad bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's son. He married Mohammed Atez, the lead organizer and pilot of one of the aircrafts on September 11th. He married his daughter. Pentagon plans scaled back spring exercise in South Korea as the Trump-Kim negotiations falter. Another one, China denies having troops in Afghanistan's walk-in corridor. And also from the New York Times, under a peace plan, U.S. military would exit Afghanistan within 5 years. There was a story I saw also, women in Afghanistan got together and they said, do not sell us out to the Taliban. We are not going to do the burqa again. We are not going back to the Stone Age. So, interesting stuff going on. All right. Now, with all of that done, I want to find this. All right. This is Eugene Sledge. Okay. And he's talking about, he's, let's see, 1994. He'd have been about 20 something. Let's call it 25. So 50 years after the war ends, 45 to 95. So he's approximately 70 years old. I'd probably between 65 and 70 at the time he does this. All right. This is presented at the Ludwig von Mises, M-I-S-E-S, Institute's The Cost of War Seminar in 1994.
The title of my talk...
He's from Alabama, I remember that.
...is such because... The Old Breed was the name given to the 1st Marine Division in World War II. I went to college, graduated from high school in 1942, and went to college in Marion Institute for 1 year and joined the Marine Corps while I was there. And I joined because I had read about the different services, talked to different people, and I came to the conclusion that the Marine Corps was the best. And ironically, after all I went through, I still think that. It had extremely high standards, and it upheld them all the time. Now, there are several places I could begin. I could begin by quoting someone... very profound and so forth. But let me just give you one quote that our DI told us the first day in boot camp. He said, you people are stupid. That was the first thing he said to us. This was before we'd had any SAT test or ACT or anything of that sort. But he said, you people are stupid. And if any of you think you can tell me what to do, step outside and I'll whip your ass right now. So that was the reality of the Marine Corps that I entered. The reality descended upon you quickly. early on in my boot camp training, I one day got out of step. I never have understood why, but I usually managed to keep up the cadence. And he walked up beside me in a very quiet voice and said, boy, you pick up the cadence or they're going to have to take us both to sick bay because it's going to take a major operation to get my foot out of your rear end. You know, I never lost the cadence after that. Never. But to press on with what I want to do today is to... give you, in part of the time, the sort of life that the frontline infantryman that Paul Fussell was and that I was. I was in the Pacific. He was in Europe. But the kind of thing that he was subjected to every day, the kind of life that the frontline infantryman experienced and what he thought about it and how it affected him then. And then I would like to make some few remarks about how what the aftermath was. Now, I will quote someone profound. Julius Caesar said that terror robs men of their power of reason and judgment and impairs their physical capacity. That is absolutely true, because the primary emotion on a battlefield was sheer absolute terror, as Paul has indicated. Even the veterans, my gunnery sergeant, who didn't seem to have a nerve in his body, told me at the first reunion I went to of the 1st Marine Division after the war, he said, "Sledgehammer, I was as scared as you were, but I just couldn't show it." And he said, "You remember that patrol we went on Peleliu into that swamp, the 40 of us, went on into this swamp to hold up 1,500 Japs that were supposed to be on the other side of the swamp, and we were supposed to hold them up long enough to get help?" He said, "That was a suicide patrol." And he said, "I didn't tell anybody." Well, when he told me then, I fell into the nearest jail 40-something years later. I think it was Paul who said that the combat veteran has to live through the experience, and then if he survives, he has to live with it the rest of his life. And how you handle yourself and what you make of yourself depends a great deal on, I suppose, your upbringing, your discipline, things of this sort. I want to make one or two remarks about the people we fought, the Japanese soldiers. To us, they were Japs. Now, with Janet Reno in there, who might attack this building at any time as though we would... as though we were Branch Davidians. Because we might have weapons in here, and there might be child abuse. You can't ever tell. The Japanese soldier was dedicated to his cause. The American propaganda machine said he was fanatical. It wasn't that at all. He just simply fought to the death, because that's the way he had been trained. He was loyal to the emperor, he believed in his cause, and when he was inducted into the Japanese army, he was brutalized, and brutality was institutionalized in the Japanese army. There are documented cases of Japanese troops first few days in combat. In fact, it lasted the first year. If he even looked at his sergeant without the proper respect, you know, what they call silent contempt. I picked up on many a rotten coconut in base camp because of silent contempt, the way I looked at somebody. But the Japanese lieutenant would have his troops stand at attention, then take a hobnailed shoe, field shoe, and stand there and beat them in the face until the face bled. And then, of course, when they got into combat, they didn't mind doing anything to their opponents. Compassion was something that was totally foreign to them. This is why they could rampage through Nanking, China, and rape and murder over 100,000 Chinese over a period of about 3 or 4 weeks. The best kept secret of World War II are the Japanese atrocities. There's not much even written about it. And don't worry about embarrassing the young Japanese by bringing it up, because the only thing they know about World War II is the U.S. bombed Japan, Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And as Paul Fussell says, anybody who thinks it was a bad idea, his life wasn't saved by it, because ours was. We were scheduled to invade Japan, and we literally would have had to kill every man, woman, and child, because they had a song that said 100,000 souls for the emperor. All right, now, war to the infantryman meant killing. And if you had any qualms about killing the enemy, you better get over it in a hurry. Because when either you made an attack or they made an attack, you kill them before they killed you. And the first one I saw, I must admit, I didn't pull the trigger on. And Snafu Shelton, my foxhole buddy, said, "What the hell's the matter with you? Do you want them in the hole here with us?" Talking about our foxhole. And I said, "No." So then the next bunch that ran out of that pillbox with their bayonets fixed, I was firing at them before he was. Typical Japanese fashion, they came out of the pillbox. This, again, is rarely written about. Rifle, bayoneted rifle in the right hand. Their unbuttoned breeches held up in the left hand. So when they got killed, they dropped their breeches. There was something in their religion or the code of Bushido that said the lower abdomen was the place of manhood instead of the chest, to the way it is to the Westerner. We thought we saw thousands of them on Okinawa lying out there with all their, but it was practically in their best day clothes, with their last ounce of strength they had pulled their trousers down. Now, on the front lines, it's a place of passion, terror, hatred, and believe me, we hated their guts. Now, it's been said by many writers, and this is very trendy, that we hated them because they were racist. We are racist. They weren't. We were. The Japanese were hated because they fought by the code of Bushido, which meant you had to kill, as I said, every last one of them before you could get the heck off the island. And when you had wounded buddies that were shot or wounded by shellfire and tried to carry them out, you had to get them out as fast as you could or they got shot on the stretcher. Because the Japs shot them on the stretcher, then they tried to shoot the stretcher team down. I had a good friend, it was a corpsman, that was working on a wounded Marine on a ridge on Okinawa one day. Doc just about got this boy fixed up, then this nip sniper shot Doc in the left leg, up in the hip, and while we were running up there with the two stretcher teams to pull him down, got Doc up on the stretcher, and that son of a bitch shot him in the other hip, just as we got him on the stretcher. Now, why didn't he shoot him and kill him? Well, he shot him two places to immobilize him where we'd have to carry him. Then he started firing at us. Well, we outran all the Olympic runners getting him down that ridge so all of us could get out of his way. And fortunately, he didn't hit anybody. Wild excitement existed on the front line. I mean, when you're so close to a guy that you can throw a hand grenade at him, but you know you better not throw it because he'll throw it back at you before it explodes, you got a decision to make. And because the problem was we probably needed Peter Jennings. Now, he's eminently qualified. They tell us so. Of course, it might meant that he would have had to wear a helmet and that would have messed up his coiffured hair. I have very little left, but I've been tempted to wear a hairpiece, but before I retired, the students often confuse me with Robert Redford. I just bring that up. But during an attack, either on our part or...
Sledge is funny, man. He's funny. And you can imagine him, right, with a couple scotches in him, letting it rip on people. Smart guy, quick wit, funny.
The Japanese part... The bombardment preceding the attack, of our attack or their attack, was so loud that it was thunderous. You couldn't even talk to the guy next to you. And at Okinawa, some of the Japanese artillery barrages went on for 4 and 5 days without stop. And when they would finally end, we were just all like that. You couldn't even hold your rifle steady because your nerves had just been so knocked about by all this terrific explosion and carrying wounded guys out, dead guys. We moved them to the rear if we could. Sometimes you couldn't move them. The violence was just inconceivable. We hit it lucky at Okinawa, with quotes around it. The Japanese had a full complement of artillery there, which to the infantryman is one of the worst things you have to put up with, except for machine guns, except for snipers, except for mortars, except for hand grenades, and except for tanks. But other than that, artillery was one of the worst things. But they had additional
Interestingly enough, sledge fights all the way through Peleliu, all the way 82 days to the Battle of Okinawa, and he's never wounded. Doesn't have a Purple Heart. And he used to get his balls busted for that. How amazing is that? I mean, just think about the amount of metal that flew through the air around that guy, and he never gets touched. At some point, right, his physical person, giving the million pieces of metal that flew around him, gets touched by metal. At some point, that just the law of probability says that happened. Never got touched.
Artillery shipped to the Philippines. Before the ships got to the Philippines, they told them to turn around and go to Okinawa, and because the Philippines were going to fall. So that meant that those of us who landed on Okinawa got a double dose of shelling. And if you don't think, when we get new second lieutenants in and full of bravado and all this kind of stuff they had learned at Quantico, one good shelling knocked it out of them. Whether they got hit or not. I mean, but poor guys, they didn't last but just a few days. Now, the machine gun fire was something at least you could get away from if you could get hunkered down in the hole. But if it caught you out in the open, it was tough. I met an attack across the airfield at Peleliu, and the machine gun, I could see the traces coming by me, just like the railings on a ship or on a porch or something like that. And the shells were just going off, just erupting to the point that you couldn't even yell to the guy next to you. After it was over with, got across, and a buddy of mine said, "Say, Sledgehammer, did you know that Billy cracked up back there on the airport and they had to actually drag him across here undercover?" And I said, "No, I didn't know that. What happened to him?" He said, "Well, you remember Joe that we all went through boot camp together with? Joe got hit in the head and he splattered his brains all over Billy's face." And it was that kind of thing that happened that was apt to happen at any time. Snipers were you developed a close personal relationship with a sniper because you lay in your foxhole with your buddy. My buddy was Snafu Shelton, who was from the swamps of Louisiana. He still had the bark on, and we had a very fascinating juxtaposition, I suppose they would call it today, of the Lord's Prayer and the 23rd Psalm on my palm, and goddamn you son of a bitch on Snafu's palm. I mean, he could cuss a blue streak because you knew that sniper was after you personally. And so therefore you could case him personally. But the problem was he never could hear you. And Japanese snipers were crack shots. They're actual records of them hitting a Marine on Peleliu at 600 yards. And so they were crack shots. The volume of fire that came at us when the Japanese pulled an attack, when you think of the amount of steel and fragments and bullets that came at a man, my company had 64% casualties at Peleliu. I didn't get a scratch. It lasted 30 days and 30 nights because they fought all night, fought us all night. But I recently got a letter from an Air Force man who had been stationed on Okinawa, and he said that on this particular ridge, he read my book, and he said on this particular ridge that we had been on, and the Japanese pulled his major, not bonsai, not the stupid kind that John Wayne mowed them down by the thousands, but a well-planned counterattack at Okinawa. He just was curious as to the volume of fire that possibly maybe he could find some. He measured off a square foot, and then he dug just below the surface, and he wrote me that he found 30 pieces of shrapnel and or bullets. And when I was out there, I thought I was going to catch every one of the 30 every time I took a step. Every man thought that he was the object of the whole and entire Japanese barrage. At night, the nights were sheer terror in the Pacific. The typical German soldier was a superb soldier from everything anybody writes or says about. He wanted to fight as honorably as he could and then get home to the family. The typical Japanese soldier wanted to fight honorably and die for the emperor. So that meant you had to kill him before you could get it over with. And because he made that difficult, because he didn't want to die. And he wanted to carry you with him. So if you took a position and wounded a bunch of them, and they were lying around, and of course we had to field strip them for souvenirs, somebody went around and
field stripping for souvenirs means taking whatever they had in their possession that might be of value. Anything from gold teeth that he writes about in the book to things of personal value like flags and whatnot.
Shot each one of them in the head routinely. Some of the outfits called the guys a possum squad. And it was said later that they must have thought all those guys that made those took those positions all crack shots because all the Japs had been shot in the head. But they would play dead. They would go to any kind.
Gives you some level idea of the level of brutality, right, in the Pacific. The possum squad. Go around and shoot everybody in the head one time, right? That's your job, right? Because of Japanese faking.
Kind of ruse to get help, such as slipping behind the lines at night and calling for a corpsman and begging for assistance. But fortunately, I went into a veteran outfit as a replacement, and you could understand the intonation of the voice. You could always recognize it. Now, the fatigue that a combat infantryman is exposed to and that he knows is there is absolutely nothing like it in civilian life. Sometimes I feel so sorry for these, I'm not much of a sports fan, but I'm a boy bird watcher, and that's what I spend most of my time outside doing. But sometimes on the news it shows these exhausted football players or exhausted basketball players, and I weep so much I almost have to paddle out of the room in a canoe because they are so tired. But Paul can tell you that when you go for 2 weeks or 30 days, or as at Okinawa it was 1 week short of 3 months, and there were about 10 of us out of my company that made it all the way through Okinawa and didn't get hit. And we were literally walking around like zombies. And I had weighed about 145 when I went into the campaign. When it was over, we got back, got up north, built a tent camp. I weighed up about 125 or 120. Everybody lost weight just from the sheer stress. You can't imagine bringing up ammunition in the mud. The 30 caliber ball, which was the standard ammo for the M1 rifle, it weighed over 100 pounds, I guess, don't you, Paul? The genius who designed the box had two little handholds in the end of it. Put the tips of your fingers in there. To lift up a box that weighed over 100 pounds in the mud, and it had mud smeared all over it. And, of course, this just brought forth more creative cursing on the part of the troops. But at night, the Japanese, as the historians say, the military historians, they tried to infiltrate the lines. At Peleliu, they had a whole battalion that was assigned to raid the lines. They weren't trying to infiltrate. They would slip up as close as they could to us, throw a grenade, and come in screaming with either a saber or bayonet or something of this sort. Now, the idea of a saber in a modern war sounds ridiculous. I had a buddy that his right arm was amputated by a Jap officer who slipped up close and then jumped in his position. I had another buddy who lost two fingers that he was holding on to his rifle, and the Jap came around with a saber like that and cut his two fingers off. And then he poleaxed the Jap just like he hit a baseball with the butt of his rifle and killed him. But they usually got killed in those night attacks, but we always had casualties. It has been shown that the longer combat went on, the worse the stress got and the more exhausted the troops got, because the fight or flight syndrome physiologically takes over. You're all keyed up. The adrenaline's pumping. And believe me, when that goes on for almost 3 months, you don't have much reserve left. When buddies were killed or wounded, many of us just simply cried because we were very, very closely knit. Even the replacements came in that way, became that way. We had a great deal of respect for each other because in the Marine Corps, they can call it brainwashing, I don't care what they call it, but the greatest sin you could commit was to let a buddy down. And so you knew you could depend on any guy that had a Marine uniform on, whether you knew his name or not. Now, at Okinawa, we went through a period of about 10 days of torrential rain. This meant the tanks couldn't move. It was right in front of Shuri, the main Japanese defense bastion. We couldn't move without the tanks because the Japs would have mowed us all down. We could move in behind the tanks, and the tank gun could be firing at 75. The outfit that had tried to take this particular ridge I was on before us had heavy casualties. Almost every shell hole there had a dead Marine in it. They couldn't get them out. The maggots were in them. The rain was washing the maggots off the dead over the top of the soil into your foxhole. The foxhole that Snafu and I dug, we had to put boards in the bottom of it and then dig a sump hole in the end of it and bail it out with an old helmet that a casualty had left. If we hadn't, it was just like a colander immersed in water. Water came over the edges of it, and water came through the soil. The spouts, just like turning on a spigot. It was raining so hard. The Japs were attacking every night. We were killing them in the lines every night. You try to throw mud on them with your entrenching tool. Then the next day or the next few days, usually in the tropics, they got pretty ripe in a day, shells would come in and blow them all apart. So the body parts just lying all over the place. The guys called it Maggot Ridge. And if you went down the ridge and slipped and fell, when you slid down to the bottom, when you came up, the maggots were falling all out of your dungaree pockets, all out of your cartridge belt and everything else. The personal filth that the infantryman had to go through is inconceivable. 3 months without a bath, living in the mud, your mouth felt like it was full of mud. You had no way to brush your teeth. But you had to stay alert. You had to be attuned to every tiny sound at night.
If you're just joining us, this is Eugene B. Sledge speaking in 1994 at the Mises Institute, and gave a talk on what it was to be a combat infantryman in World War II in the Pacific Theater of War. And so we're getting to know him a little bit. It's a pretty interesting discussion. And he's wonderful in terms of his, you know, he slides his wit and his dry sense of humor in there throughout this. But what he's describing, you know, is amazing.
Because they slipped around at night and they were experts at it. Of course, you can imagine the odor of the dead. The only way we could eat anything, your stomach was tied in knots. They gave us a little tripod-like thing. You put a steno tablet on it before dawn, because you'd draw sniper fire if you didn't. And then try to heat up a can of beans or something, and heat up a little coffee, little packages of coffee that were in the ration can. We had tremendous loyalty to the units. And this mainly is what kept us together. When you were out there and the stuff hit the fan, and it was a matter of life and death, sure, we were all fighting for the Constitution, but basically you were fighting for your buddy and he was fighting for you, because that was the elemental level. Because there wasn't anything between us and the Japs but space, and sometime at night, that space was no more than here to that chalkboard there, and if they got in your foxhole, it was a hell of a lot closer than that. The aftermath of all of this, as Paul said, there were widows, there were orphans, orphans. Many of our guys were not married, but some of them were. Some of them had children. The one thing that we were all left with was nightmares. I had them for 25 years. I'd wake up in a cold sweat, screaming, having gone through something in a dream that was just as realistic as when it happened. In a cold sweat. Some nights I was afraid I would have nightmares and was afraid to go to sleep. So I'd stay up late reading poetry or biology or something like that, hoping they didn't come. Now, the casualties, the dead, we mourn them because, like I say, if he was a Marine, you were sorry the guy got killed because he was special. And he might, if he was a buddy, you wept over it. But to the guys that were wounded, to the military historian, that's just a figure. But I have a buddy named John Huber. He lives up in Virginia. He's one of the finest young men I ever knew. Hell, he ain't young. He's my age. But he's one of the finest men I ever knew. At Okinawa, Huber's hip was terribly damaged by a Jap grenade. Here, 50 years later, he's had to have one of numerous surgical operations because his hip had to be replaced. It's thrown his spine out of line, then it threw his right ankle out of line. He's never complained because he's alive. And to Huber, to complain would be ridiculous. I had another friend named Jim Kernisel, whose family lived in Nebraska on the big wheat farm. It was his ambition, his dream, to get back and farm that wheat farm. One day I was standing right in front of on a little ridge with one of these deep Jap standing foxholes right in front of me, watching through the binoculars. Because we'd been pulled off the line. We'd made a push the day before and lost a heck of a bunch of guys out of my company. So they pulled us off the line for a few days. And I saw these mortar shells coming toward us. So I got the binoculars and was looking. And I said, the guys were incidentally out of an ammo box behind me, 6 or 8 of them, playing pinochle. And I said, you guys better look out. That nip gunner is walking them right down this little valley. Well, I got what a guy usually got in a case like that. Oh, hell, Sledgehammer, you're just nervous in the service. So I said, okay, I'm telling you, you better look out. Just about that time, there was this terrific crash as a shell exploded right in front of me down at ground level. And I was on this little hillock that was no higher, really, than that blackboard. The concussion knocked me off my feet and just down into the foxhole standing up. It wounded 5 men. How in God's name I didn't get my head blown off, I'll never know. But poor Kernisel got a bad shrapnel wound in the head. And then I had a seizure, and I fell off the tractor. And he said, when I fell, I luckily kicked it in neutral so it didn't run over me. I went to my doctor, and he said, son, you're going to have these all the rest of your life because of that head wound. Get off that farm. So he said, I had to give up the farm, and if you can believe it, loving the outdoors like I do, I'm in a damn insurance office. I had another buddy named Jim Day. Jim lived in California. He had a horse farm. When he got home, he wanted to make it into a horse ranch. At Peleliu, a Japanese machine gun literally, before my eyes, cut off Jim's right leg. It was a heavy machine gun, and he was so close to us. The nip just moved it just a little bit. It was a free gun. And poor Jim just toppled over. There was his leg lying on the ground. There was his blood spating out of the stump. I ran over there to him. The corpsman ran over there to him. When Jim would come to 1st Marine Division reunions, maybe some of you can't conceive of this, but we'd have to help him go to the bathroom because his wife had to do that at home. The poor guy couldn't do it. Now, maybe with these bars and so forth for the handicap, he could. I had a wonderful friend named Vermeer. And Marion Vermeer was a lumberjack from Washington State. He wanted to be a lumberjack when he went home. One day on a ridge on Okinawa, the Japs put some pressure on the Army. I don't mean any offense to any of you Army people out there, but they put some pressure on the Army, and the Army line moved back a little bit. That meant there was a bend in the line to the left, so the Japs got this 70-millimeter mountain gun. It was on small wheels. They could move it around real quick, but 70 millimeters was about that big. Fired a high-velocity shell. They fired a shell, and it went right behind our lines and hit out that west and knocked out tanks were. Somebody said, "What the hell was that?" One of the NCOs said, "That was a nip mountain gun." The next shell went, I am not exaggerating, no more than a foot over my head, past the foxhole next to me that had two kids that were replacements, hit in Bill Layden's hole where Bill and Marion Vermeer were. Bill was blown up into the air. Vermeer just fell over. The two kids in the hole next to me, one of them jumped up and was doing like that, and the other one was yelling, "Oh, Jesus Christ, it hurts so bad. Make me die. I can't stand it. For Christ's sake, Jesus, do something." And then he just toppled over dead. This was the glory of, and we were all after this glory stuff, see. This is John Wayne. But I'm telling you what really happened. I started over toward Layden's foxhole, and the sergeant said, "Sledgehammer, get back on the gun." The mortar was right at the base of the ridge, and I had been observing. I had more experience than the gunner they had on it. He said, "If they locate that mountain gun, I'm going to need you to get on the gun." So I must admit I was glad to get back, get down below the ridge. The gun didn't fire anymore. They brought Vermeer by me and on a stretcher. His right leg below the knee was just a bloody bandage. Thrown up on the stretcher was his boondock, or field shoe as we called it, boondock, and his ankle was sticking out of it. And he said, "Sledgehammer, you think I'll ever be able to be a lumberjack again?" And I said, "Sure, buddy, you'll make it. You'll be back in all those beautiful trees and doing what you want to do. And if you don't think I didn't feel like I'd been stabbed in the heart." They carried him about 20 yards and then put the stretcher down. He was dead. Those are some of the things that are the cost of war to those who actually fight it. And believe you me, I could wax not maybe as eloquent as Paul Fussell, but I could get my back up about Bill Clinton getting into some of these things. There was absolutely no excuse for those Rangers to get killed over there in Somalia. Experts have come out and said, they'd asked, what was the guy's name that was Secretary of Defense, whatever it was.
Aspen.
Aspen, yeah, that's it. Aspen said, well, you know, he thought about it and thought they really didn't need tanks. They come out, I think Indonesian troops sent some things up there that looked like Model T Fords, and naturally the Somalis blew them all up. But nobody can tell me the way those Rangers were situated in a circular defense surrounded by all those Somalis, if they hadn't had a couple of tanks up there, they would have gotten out of there with minimum casualties. Because believe me, when tanks came into an outfit, the gooks haul tail, because they got shot up or something was going to give. Thank you.
Eugene B. Sledge. We're going to get to know him better. We know him from his book, The Old Breed, and we know him from the way The Old Breed was depicted in the movie The Series Pacific. But we're going to get to know him in his own words a little bit better, because he's a funny dude. So we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. The chef will join us. More of All Marine Radio here on a Friday edition here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.